We are going way back old school. I don't think we've done a hangout like this since probably February, Steve.
It's been a while. It's definitely been a while. This is like going definitely old school.
Definitely. So this morning at about 8 o'clock, I was awoken by a loud crashing noise, and right outside of my house, a drunk driver had decided to take out a telephone pole. Guy walked out of the car fine. I mean, like, it was nothing, but the telephone pole was definitely damaged. So I'm without power at my place until 9 tonight, and that explains the tech issues that we had just a few minutes ago. We apologize for that, but nonetheless, we are back, and we're just going to go retro style with an old Google Hangouts. But let's say hello to the two guys that you guys probably came here to see anyway, and that would be Adam Kokish and Carl Benjamin. Welcome, gentlemen. Welcome back, actually.
Yes, thank you. By the way, that's like the best excuse you could possibly have for this. I mean, just way better than the dog ate your homework. Yeah, the drunk driver telephone pole.
I didn't think about the ramifications until about noon, where I was like, you know, oh wait, everything that I have literally for the show runs on power, and so I'm gonna have to have a backup plan. But yes, welcome back, and Carl, thanks for coming back to you.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I asked you a little bit before, but I'm just curious. How do you think tomorrow's going to go?
I honestly don't know. I genuinely have no idea. I just published a video about it just saying, well, I mean, the polls are 87% in favor of the Democrats, but then they were 97% in favor of Hillary. So,
yeah, that's true.
And the Democrats themselves aren't trusting the polls either, and I don't blame them. You know, I get the feeling that there are probably it was probably the same with Brexit over in this country, where you had a large number of people who would effectively just lie to the pollsters, because in public they'd be browbeaten by screeching leftists, and so they'd just keep their opinions to themselves and then go and vote. And they, you know, and now we're leaving the European Union. So I honestly don't know. I honestly couldn't say.
Yeah. And what about you, Adam?
Well, after hours and hours and hours of analysis, fortunately done by other people, I have come to the conclusion that a party that doesn't care about your freedom is going to win, and we have a lot of work to do.
Awesome. Well, you know, that's a good segue into what we're going to be discussing today. Why don't you, Adam, kind of give us an overview of what you feel the government should be, or how it should be run, and kind of your philosophy, and we'll let Carl kind of come in off of that.
Are you sure that's how you want to spend the first half hour of this?
takes a couple hours.
That's actually accurate. I think that you know, Steve and I usually say some words in this show, and when we had just you on by yourself, I think me and Steve got like 5 words total.
Was I even in that one? It was like all Adam's show, which was great, actually. We didn't have to do much work. It was just let him talk.
But yeah, that's what I say, a lot. Brief summary. Give us a brief summary of what you think the correct form of government should be.
Sure. Well, this kind of comes down to a matter of definitions. And as we know it, government today is a coercive monopoly based on a specific geographical territory. And if we look at ethics and what ethics dictates, how we relate to other human beings, don't hit, don't steal, don't kill, those basic moral rules are in the best interest of humanity prospering and relating to each other in a way that's good for everybody. And you don't get to make exceptions to those rules for government. It's not don't hit, don't steal, don't kill, unless you're a cop or an IRS agent or a soldier. And so that points us to this ideal of a voluntary society. I describe myself first and foremost as a voluntarist. I like the term libertarian. I think it's more general and inclusive, but specifically philosophically, the understanding that all human relationships should be voluntary if you care about human happiness and health and prosperity. And so that ideal might not be something that you can say we're ever going to achieve, in the sense that if you had a perfectly voluntary society, the minute someone gets punched in the face by a drunk guy, for that moment for him, it's not voluntary. But what we have today is a society that is dominated by coercive institutions, and governments have cut up the world into territories that cover the globe. So the question becomes, how do we get away from this? How do we transition away from this in a manner that's peaceful and orderly and responsible and transition to a voluntary society? Now, a lot of people, a lot of conservatives and libertarians, and it's a very important distinction. I don't think libertarianism is a right philosophy or a left philosophy, because right and left really describe different flavors of statism, different things that people would like to use violence and coercion in the form of the institution of government to carry on in society. So when, you know, but libertarians and conservatives, when we look at, you know, the evil of big government, we often confuse the evil with the size. And I often like to challenge libertarians by pointing out that government is not necessarily more evil because it is larger. And the thought exercise I propose very simply is, would you rather have a government that's very large, like half the population, but it more or less approximates what the market would provide and really uses just enough coercion to maintain its monopolies and respect civil liberties and is generally nonviolent, or a government that's tiny, that's 1% of the population, but say murders every firstborn child? Obviously, you'd rather live in a big government that's nonviolent, than a small government that's extremely violent. And so the measure of the evil of government and really the economic impact is how much it takes us off the state of natural harmony that a free market would provide. So anyway, how we get to that point, what I see is the most likely, the most effective, the most efficient transition is localization of government. And eventually we're going to make sure that it's completely obsolete. Technology is doing that essentially for us anyway. The idea that we would need to rely on these kinds of institutions that are based on coercion, problems that exist for lack of information, all of those are basically going away with the increase in technology that is exponential: supercomputing, artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing, life extension technology. All of these things are combining to make it possible for humanity to achieve, if not the absolute perfect ideal, the general ideal of a voluntary society that holds those standards of ethics in appropriate regard.
Okay. And Carl, what's wrong with that?
It's never going to happen.
And why not?
Because we don't have a monopoly on the government of the world. The problem that you have with any kind of... We are discussing anarchism here specifically, and not libertarianism, aren't we? Because in my opinion, the problem with anarchism is that it always loses to any kind of statism because of the effectiveness of the state to marshal a force.
Do you mind if I stop and define a term here, since you applied the label to me, you know, in anarchism?
Well, I'm asking. I mean, if you don't consider yourself an anarchist, that's fine.
Well, It becomes a matter of definitions. Like I said, voluntary is first. So I would not object to someone having an institution called government. You have the right to call it whatever you want, as long as it's not coercive, as long as it is ethical in its primacy. So you could say that if you say government is inherently the definition that I gave it as a fixed definition, that government is by definition always inherently coercive, then what I'm saying is anarchism. You can say that. Or if government can become voluntary, what I'm advocating for is a society that only has governments which are voluntary.
Okay, so government can't be voluntary. It has to be a unique legal entity with a monopoly on force, a monopoly on law-giving, probably others, to be honest, but they're the two that I think are the most important. And it has to be over a discrete geographical area. That could be the entire Earth, if we had a world state. Not that I think that's a good idea, but it's probably inevitable at some point. And I don't think there's any way of getting around that. I mean, I don't really see how you can expect people to live in perfect harmony with one another without the need for laws. And if you do need laws, then who enforces them?
Well, already, this is based on what I see as the historical trend and the immediate relevance of government. I mean, to answer your question in two parts, there's the historical part. And I like to cite the work of Professor Steven Pinker, who's not a libertarian by any stretch, a Harvard professor who has proven academically that we're living in the least violent times, the most peaceful times in human history, that we are less likely today than ever before to die at the hands of another another human being. And when you understand freedom is nonviolence, right? I mean, if we live in a nonviolent society, that's one where freedom is respected, obviously. And that trend of violence is like a radioactive decay curve. We are actually getting more capable, more harmonious, more prosperous over time. That's the nature of intelligent life progressing. So I see all of the great forces of nature, all of the great forces of history really moving us in this direction.
And can I interject here? Is that, do you mind if I just interject that? Yeah, sorry. The thing that you're describing is true, obviously. And it's true about the West especially. But I mean, it probably is true of non-Western countries that violence is declining. But the thing is, this is all a consequence of the liberal state. This is because the state exists and operates in a certain way, that it's accountable to its citizenry, that it protects private property rights, that it protects human life, using laws from lawmakers who are accountable that allow this to happen. And the second that the government breaks down, you end up like Somalia with ridiculous murder rates, with no protection of private property. So I don't see how we can abandon the mechanism by which we have created this world.
So that's one of Steven Pinker's theories as well. And I want to go back to the point you made before that humans need laws if they're going to live in harmony, if we're going to have standards, you know, and I would say that the one law that's relevant that really is the universal standard is the natural law based on self-ownership. And that is that you as an independent entity, as a sovereign consciousness, you own yourself, and it's unethical. It's wrong for anybody else to claim ownership over you. And from the Lockean concept of property rights, this is how you mix your labor with natural resources and acquire property legitimately through voluntary trade. And when I say that this is partly grounded in my observation of current reality with the relevance of government, a lot of people will say, well, we need government in order for people to have laws enforced and for people to be good. But the greater force here is not that. It's really the market forces that are prevalent to those human relationships and the accountability mechanisms that we already have for bad actors. So for someone to say, well, we need laws as in we need a government, we need an enforcer that is this arbitrary giver of a loss, a legal standard, it's like saying, well, if it wasn't for government, I'd just go on a killing spree. But when you separate the what is actually happening from the institution that is claiming credit for it, you know, and I grant you the point that a lot of human progress towards a more harmonious society is because of mechanisms of government and accountability. But if anything, they've been holding us back from better applying those technologies, from better applying our ability to hold each other accountable. So I don't think if we got rid of government, everybody would go on a murder spree. But what we would develop very soon is we'd be able to separate the false services from government that are based on the coercion and the imposition of the monopoly and the control and the exploitation and the corruption, and get down to the real legitimate justice services. Do we need a law written down? No, we need protection and accountability for people who are bad actors. The services to provide that will always be better provided by the market. And this is the one thing that I think a lot of statists, but you know, conservatives especially, can't really, you know, get around is separating these ideas. You know, they'll say we can do everything else with the free market, but if it has to do with force and violence or protection or dispute resolution, that has to be done by government. And that's the worst. That leads to the worst corruption, the worst destruction of life and property, and essentially, of course, war and, you know, things like the war on drugs and the you know, all the greater evils of government.
Okay, so how exactly would a non-governmental legal system work?
Well, there are a lot of different theories about how we would do this, but there are a lot of viable ones that look like insurance companies and dispute resolution organizations and private security that could either be community-based or completely market-based and individual-based. So,
okay, well, stop there then. Why would I cooperate with any of these?
Because if you don't, then you'll lose your reputation and you'll be ostracized from society, essentially. And if you're actually, you know, in a sense...
Hang on. But what if that doesn't matter to me? Hang on a second. What if that doesn't matter to me? What if the group of people who will find that objectionable are not the entirety of society, and I can just go somewhere else and carry on operating?
Well, give me a specific example of what you would want to do that would be bad that you think you could get away with or would want to be able to get away with.
It doesn't matter what it is. I mean, there will be no laws. So, I mean,
well,
why?
It does matter what it is. I mean, it does. It absolutely.
Okay, but who decides what's right? Who decides what's illegal and what's not?
Well, you decide based on what you agree to. So basically right now, like if you go and get it, if you go apply for a job, right, you have to provide a driver's license that identifies you and, you know, allows your employer to run a government, you know, it's okay, whatever, background check to say you're not a wanted criminal. What you'd have in a market system would be a better system of accountability, where in order for you to do business with someone, you would have to sign up to say, I have agreed to this, you know, in insurance system or to this dispute resolution organization system or whatever the market demands for you to be able to do business with me. But that mechanism that we see provided for by government and we kind of take for granted, it's very easy for the market to replicate that in a
Okay, hang on a second. Let's not rush off because, I mean, how are you going to stop me from just doing any kind of transaction with another person without following these rules?
How am I going to stop you from doing a transaction? I don't want to stop you from doing a transaction. That's the point. What do you mean?
Well, then that renders your system irrelevant because however you plan it for you personally, if I don't buy into that and someone else doesn't buy into that, then you become irrelevant as we continue trading without you.
Well, of course, you can trade and I can choose to opt out of your trade system or I can opt into your trade system and play by your rules. I would have that choice.
Sure. But I mean, we now need a codified method of guaranteeing contracts. Who's going to guarantee the contract between us?
Right. The same thing I described before is that you would have an insurance company or a dispute resolution organization that you would have to sign on to.
What if we didn't sign on to it?
Well, then you can do business without it. I mean, like, look, this is great.
I think that
assuming a standard of government perfection here. And one of the things that we see that's so destructive about government having a monopoly on justice services is that they're very limited. It is that, like, I'll give an example. This is like going back to when I was in college, right? I had a motorcycle stolen from in front of my dorm. When I got back from Iraq, that was my deployment toy. And I was like, you know, big, big treat for myself. And it got stolen. This guy cut the straps off the helmet with a razor blade, jacked the ignition with a screwdriver, ran off and had his girlfriend got caught with her on the back on a high speed chase on the freeway. The bike got trashed. I had to go pick it up and I went to court and I got a judgment for restitution against this guy. The government said, yeah, this guy owes you the damages to this motorcycle, and this is going to go on his criminal record. And the guy went to jail. The government spent tens of thousands of dollars, at least housing and dealing with him. And the few thousand that I was owed, instead of me getting that from the people who are supposed to serve me in terms of justice, they taxed me more to pay for his housing and pay for all the services that he receives now as an ex-prisoner. That's absolutely backwards. The system that I'm talking about is one that's based on making people whole when victims are created by actual material crimes. That's something that we just don't have under this government system. It's a very terrible approximation. It's because we don't have that accountability. When markets are able to provide accountability for those basic services, we're going to have way better services in every regard.
I don't agree. And I don't think there's any way you can compel people to follow any of this. And if people aren't compelled to follow any of this, then why should they listen to you?
Well, what do you mean by compel?
Let me explain. You just asked a question. I'll explain. I want to
point out the difference here. I don't want to compel anybody to do anything.
Well, you can't run a civilization then.
Well, if you mean compel by incentive, then I'm with you. If you mean
compulsion. Like with the chap who stole your motorbike, he's not just going to bring it back, is he? He has to be compelled to relinquish the motorbike.
Right. So in that sense, the system that I'm advocating is capable of using force in the sense of restorative justice. If you mean that there's someone who's an immediate threat or there's stolen property that needs to be returned, absolutely.
Okay, but
and we have that more. We'd have that too, more efficiently than the government. I'm not saying that the system would have coercion or compulsion at all, but that compulsion would still have to be in accordance with the natural law. So you wouldn't be compelling anyone to do anything unless they've already committed a crime.
Yeah, but or in the who process, defines what a crime is?
Basically, the natural law. The natural law is the standard, and that's what we're achieving.
But what if I don't agree with natural law?
Well, then only people who want to do business with you will do business with you, and that's fine. You don't have to agree. That's the best part of this. You don't have to agree on everything. Okay. You can have your own.
Let's talk this through seriously, right? Because, like, if I don't believe in property rights, say I'm a socialist, and I just go along and I find a motorbike, I like it, I take it, and someone comes and says, well, hey, that motorbike belongs to someone else, I'll say, well, I don't recognize your jurisdiction, I don't recognize your authority, I don't care about your opinion on the concept of private property, and I'm currently sat on this motorbike, now you have to make me relinquish it. Where does the authority to come from to make them relinquish it?
Well, so there's an important balance to be struck here that the market is capable of providing that the government cannot. And that's, is it worth using force to go after someone? Is it in the best interest of justice? Is it worth the cost? And I trust the market. I trust people interacting voluntarily to figure out what that balance is better than government. So let's say it's a stolen motorcycle.
Let's not go off another tangent. Hang on a sec. Come on.
Let me bring it back to that example.
You've made your point, man. Come on. You trust the markets to be able to get your motorbike back?
If I have an insurance company that is responsible for protecting my property or that has some agreement with me to provide a certain service, and it's if my property is stolen, they're responsible for making me whole, but they get the claim to that property. It's up to them to decide if they want to reclaim it by force, as long as I'm made whole in accordance with that service contract.
Okay. And on what authority do they have to take back something that is assumed to be stolen by force?
If someone steals your wallet and you chase him down the street and you take your wallet back, what authority do you need to take your wallet back?
Well, because the person's actually broken a law.
Well, he's stolen your property, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so you're saying that if someone steals your wallet, you need a law on file somewhere with an authority in order for you to go and tackle him and take your wallet back?
Oh, no. I could operate under the law of the jungle, obviously. I could, you know, if I'm capable
of... Well, that's not the law of the jungle. You said he committed a crime.
Look, if I'm capable of catching him and overpowering him, then sure, I have the physical capacity to take my wallet back. But if I'm not, and, you know, I imagine that most people are probably not stronger than the criminals who rob from them, then I can't get my property back unless there is a third party governmental style institution that is capable of tracking this guy down in, you know, without my presence, returning my property and then punishing the criminal to make sure that other people realize that there are punishments for doing this. And that's, I think, a necessary part of having a civilization with private property. So the question is, from where does the legitimacy derive for whoever has to do that?
Well, what would if you were capable of picking up your own wallet, what's your authority from that?
Because it was mine and I can physically take it. It's the law of the jungle. Might makes right.
No, that's not. Well, see, you're doing it based on a legitimate property claim. So it's not law of the jungle because you don't
I'm
have
doing it because I'm stronger than the guy.
Well, but you don't. But you're not going around and taking other people's wallets. You're taking your wallet back. You're restoring.
Yeah, but if I realize that I'm the strongest guy around, I could just go around and take other people's stuff, couldn't I?
Well, no, because there would be mechanisms of accountability for that would be better than what we have under government today. So, no, absolutely not.
I don't think they would. In fact, this is something that happened in the 10th century in Norway, where you would have this kind of right of challenge where you would walk up to someone who owned a farm and, you know, is married, owned a farm, and they would challenge them to fight for what they owned. And if they were slain, then they took their wife, their family, their farm, all their property, and it was completely legal. And it had to be outlawed. Because obviously you got some guys who were really good at fighting and they started amassing a lot of property pretty unjustly. So I don't think that is a better mechanism than a government.
Like royalty did. Governments have.
Yeah, like feudal.
Your example is one where governments don't like competition. Don't steal. The government hates competition.
It wasn't the government. It was the king of Norway, and that was under demand from his own citizens.
Right, because other people were getting in on his game.
No, the subjects of the king were being murdered and having their property stolen and their family stolen. So they demanded the king impose some kind of law and order and prevent this kind of blood right. Well, I can't even remember the name of it now, but prevented that from happening.
My point was normally that's what governments do. That's how kings became kings.
Yeah, that's the point of them. Yeah. Someone needs to be the font of law and order.
Eventually, we don't need that.
Well, I mean, it's possible at some point in the far future that there won't be crimes, maybe, but I find it highly unlikely. And I mean, at the end of the day, you're always going to get people who commit crimes, or what we consider to be crimes, for reasons that aren't about property. And normally the communist argument is, well, no one has any private property. When we're post-scarcity, it won't matter, because what we need laws for? But I don't think that's going to be the only reason that people commit crimes. I mean, like, you know, how are they going to prevent an Elliot Rodger from going on a killing rampage? Or what are they going to do about it when he does, you know?
Well, this gets to a little bit to the nature of human progress. I mean, if you want to get into that side of it, although I don't know if our hosts have anything that they'd like to intervene with. And I know,
this is thrilling. You guys are doing just
fine. We're just listening at this point.
You guys are doing just fine.
All right. Well, I mean, I kind of want to put Carl on the spot here and turn it back around and say, when what I'm advocating for is the realization of the natural trend of human progress, where crime does become less likely, as you agreed to that basic academic observation that human violence is on the decline, that we get more harmonious, we get more prosperous, there is less crime over time. Part of it is there is less want, but all of the incentives for violence and crime decrease over time as humanity gets more capable. And
what are you asking me to explain here exactly?
Well, how is it beneficiary to humanity to say, let's entrench an authority that has a monopoly on violence in order to achieve a more harmonious society?
Because it removes the legitimacy from us doing violence to one another.
By creating legitimacy for its own violence? See, yeah. What I'm talking about is so you're saying you want your objective here. I think you're agreeing with me on this, is that the objective here is to, as a society, delegitimize violence, correct?
No, violence will always be the final factor in any kind of conflict. Always. There's no greater factor. It will always be the last one. The problem with violence is that it hurts people. It's dangerous. It's something most people don't want to have to experience in their daily lives. So we have to find a way of managing this. We can't pretend it's not a part of the human experience, because it is. So what can we do about it? And it seems the best solution is to invest a sovereign with the monopoly on force. And then you say, well, that's a king. It's like, yeah, it is. So what we need to do is find ways of keeping that accountable. So we actually go to democracy. And that means that we can create a massive bourgeois society with a state that is actually remarkably small. And this prevents most people from doing violence to one another, because they know at the end of the day, no matter what they do, there is a state that is invested with the power and has the resources to track down any one individual or group of individuals and subdue them.
So you're going back. This is the fundamental difference. You're going back to a specific service provided by government. Yes. That I'm saying would be better provided by the free market.
I really don't think it will. But the reason that the government is a unique legal incorporation is because it's coercive and has a monopoly on force in a certain geographical area, as you described at the beginning. The way that this has legitimacy is that it is directly accountable to the people that it rules over. Your mercenary company mercenary company is not accountable to me, and so I would not recognize the authority of that mercenary company. So if they came and said, well, Adam Kokesh alleges that you beat up his brother or something, I would just be like, well, get bent, and then pull out a gun. You know, I'd be like, what are you going to do about it? And they would have to come with a remarkable amount of force, you know, because you assume that everyone's going to expect that kind of reaction. So, I mean, it would turn into some kind of Mad Max-style world. It would be terrible.
Well, first of all, it's really the opposite, in that you would have greater disincentives for crime because you'd have greater accountability for all sorts of petty crimes. But this is the main thing now. Again, I think where you're out of touch with just the basic reality of what the difference is between government and the free market, where you right. say that a government, a sovereign through a democracy is accountable. I mean, in what fantasy land of statism has that really effectively worked? Have we seen governments held accountable by voting populations? I mean, do you really
2016.
Think that is better? Oh, yeah, okay. Do you really think that that is a better mechanism of accountability than the instant and total accountability that the market provides, where you withdraw your business as soon as you don't like what someone is doing. In the case of government, you don't have that power.
I don't think there will be a market as you understand it without a government.
Markets don't exist because of governments. They exist despite governments.
No. They exist because of protection of private property rights. And without the protection of private property rights, the market won't exist as you understand it.
Again,
there won't just be a supermarket that you can go to and buy things at. That won't exist.
So again, you're premising this on the idea that there's an appropriate disincentive in theft for government. If anything, what government does in its justice system is encourage petty theft. And I live in a community where we have accountability, where people have reputations, and those who are good actors, you know, are treated as such, and those who are not are held accountable for that. But it would be better if we had something other than government, because we can't call government when you have $100 in damages, when you have, you know, a bicycle stolen. Even for me, with a motorcycle stolen, with, you know, thousands of dollars of damages to the bike itself, I didn't have a system of accountability. I want to be able to hold those people accountable. Government doesn't.
Hang on. I thought you said the guy went to jail.
Yeah, but I didn't get any restitution. And now there's another thing here.
Hang on. Stop going off on tangents, man. Come on, let's take this step by step, right? So the guy went to jail. Did you not get your bike back? Did he not have to pay for the damages?
He did not have to pay for the damages. So I didn't see a dime of that. No.
You didn't have an insurance company or something?
No, not for the damages by theft. No.
Right. Okay. I don't know how.
It was a few thousand. I think I had a $500 deductible or something.
I don't know how American law works in that regard. But I mean, I would have to look into that.
The judge didn't order restitution, though, Adam.
No, the judge ordered a restitution, and there was no enforcement of it. The guy went to jail. The government spent thousands of dollars housing him and processing him, and he was put back on the streets and was never in any way compelled to pay me back. But and so this still, is an important.
You can still
this
goes back for that though.
Yeah, you can go to civil.
You have that judgment against him.
Yeah. Right. And if I want to get that money back, how much do I have to pay?
Well, he'll pay the lawyer. He'll pay the costs if you win the case, which it sounds like you'll win the case.
Right. And this is something, I mean, this guy is now a homeless crack addict from what I was told by his probation officers who are supposed to be. See, there already is a mechanism of killing. This is the insanity of statism. It didn't work once. Let's do it again. But the idea of punishment versus justice, this is absolutely critical, because if you're punishing someone, and this might be a definitional thing, you know, you said you wanted someone who stole from you punished. I don't want them punished. I want justice, and I want them to be held accountable. And that's an important distinction, because so maybe you're agreeing with this, but I want to make it clear that
let's stop like galloping on from point to point, because these are important distinctions. Punishment is a component of justice. It doesn't have to be the only component. I mean, one thing that you might need to do to achieve justice is to punish the person who's committed a crime.
What's your definition of punishment?
A punishment is something that is applied to a person who's committed a crime in order to make sure that they don't do it again, as a way of incentivizing them not to do it again, in ways of incentivizing other people not to do the same thing. But the problem that you have, again, like who metes out this justice?
Okay, so this is really an important understanding of natural law and the definitions here, because you made the definition of punishment there somewhat inclusive of, say, like if someone commits a crime, let's say someone murders someone because they are insane and they need to be locked up to be isolated from society. That's something that happens to someone who's committed a crime, but it's not to punish them. It's in the interest of justice to forcibly isolate them to prevent them from murdering again. So I make
this also a way of punishing them. You can't separate the two. I mean,
let me finish and explain, and you'll see the distinction here. Because if you punishment, I equate with hurting someone or causing someone pain or damages or suffering in order to control their future behavior. And you kind of included that in your definition, saying to prevent them from doing that again in the future. And so you're using force and violence and hurting someone in a way that's outside of justice in order to compel behavior by the natural law definition.
Okay, stop.
Well, Let me finish. You can't just go on and on about justice. I disagree with you at the first level.
You say that like punishment isn't a part of justice. Well, I think it is. So, I mean, like, okay, so.
So how do you separate that then? So when someone, Adam,
you can't talk over each other because then nobody can hear you. Carl's talking. Let him finish his thought.
We'll give you all the time you need.
Yeah, promise. Right. We promise, man.
So you think that there should be justice that doesn't involve any kind of physical harm or suffering or what I would describe as punishment, or is that correct?
I think it should all be in the interest of justice. If that's incidental, you can say that might happen. If someone is coming to punch you in the face and you have to tackle them and hurt them to stop them, sure, yeah, you're going to use force, you're going to use violence. They're going to get hurt in that, you know, in that instance. But if someone steals from you, I'm much more in favor of accountability for people as debtors rather than as someone who needs to be forcibly isolated. So the hypothetical possibility of a debtor's prison would be more in line with justice. So if someone steals your wallet or someone steals something from you that they don't have the ability to make you whole by themselves, that they can say, you know what, in order to maintain my reputation with the community, I'm going to sign up for something that allows me to work in a way that pays this person back. That's justice. If they're not an immediate, this gets back down to the natural law. When is it okay to use violence against someone? And I would make the case that it's only okay to use violence against someone when it's in the interest of justice, in the sense of the natural law, in prevention of a crime. If someone is, you know, there's an immediate threat to life or limb, it's defensive violence. If it's restoring property, then it's restorative, you know, might be coercive, but hopefully it wouldn't be violent necessarily.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know, that's your opinion on that. So I guess like, as far as I can see from what, and I've had this discussion with anarcho-capitalists before, I honestly think that this is something that is utterly unworkable and will degenerate into feuding tribes, effectively, that will, and out of this will come a governmental structure.
You're describing the current state.
Yes.
The world is set up into warring tribes.
Yeah, I know. Because we didn't start with a governmental structure that was accountable to the people. We started with anarchy, and that turned out to be a bad idea because we couldn't hold any property. It was difficult to become prosperous. It was dangerous. It was brutal. And it was only through this long progression of the century, the millennia, that we've come to this point where we've actually managed to get a hold on what an accountable government is, the purpose of government being to protect human rights, that we've started to essentially create a bourgeois world through the liberal state. And I think you're looking at the consequences of this process and saying, that's nice. Now, can we get rid of one component of it? And the answer is no, because all of this was necessary to arrive in the position we're in now.
Well, see, you take a view of history here to say that we started with anarchy, and I would say that's really not in line with historical reality. You could say that we started with tribalism, and you could say that that's not government in an institutional sense. But again, if you look at the definition of government that we agreed on for this conversation, that it's a territorial monopoly on violence, in a tribe where whoever can pick up the biggest rock is in charge, that's a different kind of statism. In fact, I'd say that's an extreme form of statism. If anything, we've come away from that over history.
I mean, for example, like that's domination. That's not a government. Yeah. That's
well, it meets our definition. A government can be domination too.
It can be. It can be a feudal order, like you're saying. But that's again, I do not honestly think we are going to be able to go to a position where we have no government to effectively keep people in line and still have private property rights. I mean, like in the 60s in Vancouver, the police stood down for one day and it took 4 hours for the first bank to be robbed. You know, I mean, I think what you're saying is fantastical, I have to say.
Well, you would agree that government has gotten less violent over time and that humanity has gotten less violent over time,
no,
right?
Not at all. I mean, it depends where you are. There are loads of different kinds of governments. Well, but you're treating all government as if it's just the same. There are massive differences in governments.
Of course. But I'm just going back to the original point that you agreed to when I referenced Professor Pinker's work, that humanity has gotten less violent over time. Would you agree?
Yeah, because of the liberal democratic state.
Okay, and have governments gotten more or less violent over time?
Well, which ones?
Overall.
Well, the Nazi government was pretty violent, but I wouldn't consider them to be a liberal democratic state.
Well, so, see, this is incorporated in Steven Pinker's work because he's looking at a time period of history where we had, by any definition, large modern institutional governments. And even over that period, they have gotten less violent over time. So governments...
You're misinterpreting what he said. You're misinterpreting what he said there, right? So you are taking the violence done between people in society and ascribing that to the government.
I'm separating those two things. My point is that Professor Pinker's work includes government violence. It includes war.
Right. Oh, right. Okay. So
I'm saying it includes that. It's covering both interpersonal violence and government-based interpersonal violence.
So are you saying that he said that Tsarist Russia killed more people than Soviet Russia?
No, he said the overall aggregate trend across the globe for all of humanity, including violence done by governments in mass pogroms and exterminations and the Holocaust and every other war, including all of those things, governments as well have gotten less violent over time. Yeah.
But that's because of the victory of liberal democracy.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fine if you want to attribute to that. All I'm saying is that trend is going to continue, and that's a good thing, and we should encourage that trend.
Well, I agree. But you can't get rid of the liberal democracy that's causing that trend.
You sound like the people who said we can't get rid of the monarchies that are causing this trend.
No, I don't. No, I really don't.
We can't do it because it's always been this way.
A different point.
No, it hasn't always been this way. It used to be really awful, and it took a lot of work to get to this point. And you're mistaking the cause for the effect.
And you're saying now we figured it out and now we never have to change it again. This is it.
No,
this
not
is
at all. It's constantly changing. Constantly.
You're saying this concept of modern liberal democracy, that humanity has settled on this, we're not going to progress to any other form.
No, I'm sure we'll find something better as it goes. And in fact, question, Adam. Well, just quickly, I actually really do agree with your idea of sort of like localism, your sort of the decentralization of power from central government. I totally agree with that. But the concept of central government is still going to have to exist.
Well, how local then?
Negotiation then, isn't it?
It's really beautiful that this is something that reasonable people can agree on, that people should have the right to subdivide according to their own desires for social organization, for government, that you should have the freedom. But then how local? So like if a state has the right to secede...
Well, okay, I don't need an example. I know what you mean when you say the question, right? So I think it's really important for us to delineate between the state and society, because as far as I can see, you're conflating the two and they're not the same. For example, you are actually as free as you probably need to be. You probably can go and do whatever you want tomorrow, right? I mean, for example, if you want to join a golf club or something like that.
No, I can tell you what I'm trying to do here in Arizona, but I can't tell you publicly. Otherwise, I won't be able to do it.
Okay.
There are a lot of things I can't do here.
I dread to think what those things are.
I've been threatened by the county. So.
Okay. Like I said, I dread to think what those things are, but. I can't build a house. Really?
I'm not free enough to build a house on my own property.
Right. But I mean, you probably do have to apply for some kind of permission there, don't you?
It's a lot more than that.
Right.
But that's all I'm going to say for now.
Okay. Well,
you made it sound like it was something nefarious. No, I want to build a house on my own property. Like
if you apply for a permit, could you get one if you wanted to build your own house? I mean, is that something that you could actually apply for? Or are they just saying outright you can't buy it?
Build your own house. That's something I can't get into in my specific case.
Okay.
Right. Okay. Well, then let's drop that for now. Let me go back to what I was saying, because what I mean is, okay, yeah, sure. There are going to be certain, I mean, with private property, you do have to have some sort of regulations because you live in a society. There are people around you. You know, I mean, if you build, I don't know, a giant fortress in the middle of your housing estate and then have blaring sirens every day, then yeah, there are probably legitimate complaints from your neighbors. But what I mean is that you as an individual, you are free to operate in society however you like, practically. You know, you can associate in whichever way you like and join whatever clubs, you run your life as you want according to your job and your needs, and obviously that you are actually relatively free in that regard. The government isn't getting involved, and comparatively, the government is relatively small. I mean, there are, like you were saying earlier, the situations where the government was far bigger and far more intrusive than in a Western liberal democracy. So, I mean, I agree that we should try and reduce the size of government. I would like to see that too. And I would like to see powers devolved to local centers of government that are also accountable to the central government, because then you have a much more responsive form of government to the people who are in the local area and who need local things to be done.
You're saying still subsidiary to a larger government. You're not saying does a community have a right to secede?
They can try. I mean, it depends, doesn't it? You know, it depends.
I'm not asking you, is it going to be successful? I'm saying, is it righteous? Is it just? Do you have a right? Were the American founders right to say we don't want to be part of the British Empire anymore?
It depends on their standards.
Don't I get to set the standard for my community, or don't we get to say, like, because if King George sets the standard, we're still part of England. If the American people set the standard, the colonists set the standard, then we're not. And then there's a fight over it. But the question is, who's right in that? I mean, are you saying that King George was right to say, kill the colonists for asserting their independence?
I don't know. Would it be right for California to secede from the United States because it was full of communists?
Absolutely. That would be wonderful.
That would be wonderful. that would lead to the breakup of the United States. But I suppose you'd be in favor of that. So,
well, the political breakup of the United States would be the restoration of freedom for America, would be America leading the world forward as it once did in the American Revolution, the first revolution.
Right. And how do you stop the Chinese from taking over?
Well, this is where the wisdom of the founders of the first revolution were so important, so relevant, because they were against the concept of a standing army. They knew that a better, more effective and more righteous defense of a free people would be a militia defense. And again, it comes back to incentives, and that the best defense of a free people is a well-armed public that refuses to be governed.
Let's stop there, because we know that a militia is not as good as a standing army.
For what purpose?
Fighting.
The purpose is not to fight. The purpose is to effectively defend an area.
Protection. You've got to do that by fighting.
I'm military or ex-military. You may have to fight.
Yeah. And a standing military is way better than a militia, which is why we have them.
Do I have to remind you of the Revolutionary War again? I mean, it was the American forces that were largely militia-based that fought the British lined up in rows, who made it really easy for them to die. It's right there. The evidence is in your face.
Stop before we start getting carried away with mythos, because you needed the standing army of the French to achieve this. So,
all right. You want to argue with me that way? You can bring it in both ways. It was very large and complicated. The overall trend was obvious.
Listen, I'm a big fan of military history. And if there is one thing that you learn, it's that a professional military is always better than a militia. Always. Ask our military host here.
Yeah, Steve.
What was the actual question, though?
Which is more effective, a standing military army or a militia?
Well, I mean, a standing army has been far more trained than any kind of well-regulated militia. Would you agree?
Of course.
Yeah.
And they're going to be better armed because they're backed by a state, and they're going to have much better coordination because they're trained and drilled and they have an infrastructure behind them. And they're going to have much better weapons because they're provided by a nation. The idea of a militia can't.
Absolutely.
I don't think a militia is going to do much in the modern era. Frank.
You're dealing with
except bankrupt the entire United States government.
Like, when you bring up the founding fathers, we have a lot more threats nowadays that are
Right. And we address them with the military, and Afghanistan still deserves the name, the graveyard of empires. What can a militia do? Bankrupt an empire. There you go. I mean, it's and this goes back to understanding what war is and an understanding of what governments are as territory.
Hang on. Let's not jump off topic because Afghanistan being the graveyard of empires is kind of a British colloquialism. And it was for the British Empire, or at least you could argue that, but that's not necessarily true. I mean, for like 500 years, they were ruled by the Persians. So, you know, it's one of these things that it's everything in that regard is relative. And okay, you don't live in Afghanistan anyway. So.
Adam?
I don't understand the significance of me not living in Afghanistan, but okay.
It's easy to fight a defensive war when you have a force multiplier in the form of rocky and in inhospitable terrain, right? But the US is, at least on the eastern side, quite nice and pleasant and welcoming, and would be relatively easy to move across, which is, I'm sure, what the colonists found. So how is a militia going to fight against that, a superior force? You don't have a force multiplier in the form of terrain on your side.
I think it gets down more to the principles of what the founders were advocating in terms of what is a righteous and effective defense and what war is and what government is, and the fact that it exists primarily to exploit people. And so when a people say as a whole, we're not going to take it from anybody, we're not going to be governed by anyone, we're not going to put up with any form of taxation or intrusions on our freedom, then the incentive for another government to try to take over that territory goes away. And should they overcome them militarily, they will probably lose more lives in the process, even if the occupied area loses to an invading force in a sort of force on force military sense. The invading force will probably lose more lives in the conflict to a population that's resisting with a guerrilla style force. And that population, if they are really committed to those principles, will be able to overthrow that oppressive occupying force. That's a more common trend in history.
Well, I don't think so. We didn't see that in Afghanistan.
Violent revolutions.
I don't think so. We didn't see that in Afghanistan. I can't think of anywhere that you really have seen that. So I don't agree. But I mean, I think we're kind of getting off the topic here, really, aren't we? But I mean, is there anything else we really need to discuss? Because I mean, I just don't see where any legitimacy comes from in the situation that you're describing, the civilization you're describing. Because, why should I cooperate with any of it?
And we're winding down, too, so we're hitting that hour mark. I just had kind of one question maybe that can kind of spark up a little bit. We got about 10 minutes left before the hour's up. But, Adam, last time you were here, we started to go into the who would pay for some of the things, some of the infrastructure that we had, and we said that we would approach that the next time you were on. So I'm wondering if you have an answer for things like roads or schools. Who would cover that kind of funding if we are
sure
if we get rid of the government?
Well, the important problem with government is that in terms of the problem that you raise here of allocating funds for large social projects that require significant cooperation, is that when you trust an institution that effectively has far less accountability through the electoral system than you would have through the market, that a lot of the funds that they take in terms of taxes are going to be diverted based on corruption and special interests. So when you have a market-based system for funding those things, those funds go directly from the people who want those services to those service providers. And in different forms, you're going to have different ways that people, bring those resources together, whether it's at a community level or a, private property or a business enterprise or an investment level. Those things, those resources are going to now be invested directly in what those people want without the diversion of government.
So can I just, the way that I can only envisage what you're suggesting happening is if a giant corporation had effectively their own private military to protect all the property that they own.
Well, already a lot of corporations end up with, private security that they rely on more heavily than government. They rely on private security. I mean, generally, a lot of companies.
Hang on. So, no, I don't agree with that, right? For example, there are building projects going on all the time, and whenever I travel anywhere,
hold on. You don't agree with my observation that there are companies that have private security?
No, I'll let if I can finish. For example, I go, there's a building site near my house. There are no guards on it. Why not? Why aren't there guards on a building site near my house? There are materials just left all over the place. Valuable materials. They're just left all over the place.
Yeah, the cost isn't justified.
No, because they know no one's going to steal it. And if someone does steal it, then that person will be found.
Okay.
Because there's an authority to go to with the grievance.
Well, it's not because there's an authority. It's because there's an institution there that provides that service. That institution right now is government.
Yes, because government is the only legitimate means we have of doing that. Otherwise, you return to a feudal-style system of existence.
There are lots of private mechanisms that are legitimate for doing that. I mean, like go back to the wallet example. You wouldn't say that someone who takes his wallet back from a thief is illegitimate, that his authority on that wallet is illegitimate. No, it's in line with natural law.
No, yeah, but that's the problem that I have with what you're saying, because what you're saying is might makes right.
No, I'm saying that the natural law is a standard based on self-ownership and ethics makes what's right.
Yeah, but you're not advocating for that. You're saying that I can do this because I can. Right. Okay, so here's a way of conceiving it. Property rights exist in other people's heads, not your own.
Sure. I mean, I can work with that model that property rights are an abstraction. Sure.
Yeah, they exist. Other people have to believe you have property rights.
Right. It's about respect for control of property, right? That people respect your control of it.
Yeah. And people tend to respect control of property from fear of punishment.
I think fear of punishment is not the greatest restraint on unethical behavior. I think the human conscience and accountability to people around you is far more significant, because otherwise theft and murder would be a lot more rampant. I mean, do you think government is really effective at stopping all forms of violence and criminality? I mean, people can still get away with a lot.
I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but I think it would happen in much greater degree if we didn't have that. And we can tell from countries that don't have the rule of law. I mean, this is the thing, right? All of Western prosperity is built on property rights, the rule of law, and an accountable government. That's it. These three things will make any civilization prosperous and wealthy and peaceful. And you want to get rid of at least two of those things.
Well, hold on a second. So I think we've done it. Like, this has been really intense, and like, we've been really focused and like really, really direct and intellectually focused. This hasn't been. It's been fun in an intellectual sense, but it's been kind of lacking any fun and kind of. More lively interaction with Steve and Kyle or the audience. But I think we've done, Carl, I think we've done a really good job so far of showing our differences. But there's one point of getting towards, a similarity here or perhaps a more important agreement as because I compared to a lot of the statists whom I've debated, I have a lot of respect for your level of thoughtfulness. You know, there are a lot of easy arguments that I can use to defeat statism, and a lot of other people that I can't use against you. Like, oh, you're just doing it because of tradition, or because you were told that, or whatever. Obviously, yours is much more thought out here. But there was really one critical point, and you said you agreed with me on localism, but I define that, I think, a little bit differently, because there's subsidiarity as like the Catholic Church principle of let's have all functions happen at the lowest level possible, but let's still have this pyramid to the central authority of the Vatican and the Pope. And what it sounds like that's what you're advocating in localism. And what I'm advocating in what I call specifically localization is that governments be allowed to themselves splinter off and become localized, that the right of secession be respected. And I correct me if I'm wrong, maybe I interrupted, but I don't think you really answered were the American colonies, did they have the right to declare their independence? Does a state today, does California have the right to secede?
I can answer that quite easily. It depends from the perspective you're coming from, but from the perspective of King George, no, they didn't have the right. From the perspective of the US government, no, California doesn't have the right. That's why you have to use force.
Okay, but what's your perspective then?
Well, that was it. I mean, like, that's the you know, that's it's part of your constitution that your territories aren't just allowed to secede. And ultimately, if you want to maintain any kind of state at all, which I know you don't, you have to have that. But that
doesn't now mean... you're doing the appeal to authority thing because it's in the constitution. I'm asking you what
I just explained why. I'm just an observation. You have to have that to prevent a state from splintering apart and destroying itself, which. I mean, I'm accepting of, but I really do agree with you on the I like your pragmatic view of it that you started with at the beginning, where you're saying, look, I don't think this is going to happen tomorrow, but I would like to see a decentralization of power and executive decisions to the lowest possible level, to the local community level. And that I completely agree with you on. I just don't think that we can abandon the idea of a central sovereign. The lawmaking body has to make laws.
So again, how central? And this is, again, I really want to put you on the spot here. So if you were alive, if you were a British citizen living in the colonies during the American Revolution, what side would you be on?
Oh, I would have been fighting the monarchy, obviously.
Okay, so you believe that the colonies had the right to secede from the empire? Then no, does California?
They didn't have the right to do it. If they had the right to do it, they wouldn't have had to fight. But I think they had a just cause.
The just cause being unjust taxation.
Yeah. That's one of the reasons I want Brexit. So, you know, I think the EU is an illegitimate organization. I don't think that being taxed to pay for them to do anything is just. So I want to leave. And I would dread to think what would happen if years and years went by and we still haven't left the EU. I think you'd start to see terrorism. Not from me, obviously.
So what would you say to Wales if Wales says, well, we don't want to pay taxes to the central British authority now. We want to be independent the same way that Britain wanted. We as Britain as a whole wanted to be independent from the Union.
They wouldn't be allowed.
I think we just need to start wrapping this up a little bit. I know
we may well do what we did with Scotland and have an independence referendum. And I guess we're totally oppressive because the Scots voted to stay. So we can't be that bad, but, they did, and it was, I'm not even saying that we can't have referendums and do things like this, but I think the primary thing is that people in a given polity have to live under a coherent set of laws, and so your idea of decentralizing sovereign power that's not possible. You can't create second sovereigns because then you create a rival state that will set its own rules and eventually come into conflict with the superior states. One of the problems of feudalism.
So are you saying that if it were to happen by referendum, by a sort of legal, accountable, transparent political process, you support group's right to secede then? As long as it's done.
It depends. It really depends because it's a remarkably complex thing and it's going to take us a long time to get into because you have to start going back into like historical sovereignty and things like this. But I mean, like, if a city wants to secede, probably not. But I mean, if you've got a country like Scotland who voluntarily entered a union, then if they at some point want to disassociate from that union, then you know, and if they petition for a referendum, they get it. I don't have any problem with that.
Okay, so the reason I'm trying to drill down here as a matter of principle is that the principle that I've taken on this is that if an individual owns their own property, they have a right to secede and choose to be sovereign on their own property, and that it's wrong for a political authority to say, no, we are going to force ourselves on you because we have more people because might makes right. I say that's wrong. I think every individual human being has the right to self-sovereignty, and that we concede that to an authority in any way that we choose, by where we choose to live, what agreements we sign, what institutions and organizations we choose to be a part of, but that it should all be by choice, and that only is truly respected when the individual right to sovereignty is respected.
I think I would like to agree with what you're saying, but it's fantastical, and frankly, I think you're going to create a prison for yourself, because if a person was allowed to just
I'm not saying it's always immediately wise.
It might not be wise, because if I were the government, if some guy was like, right, I've got like 5 acres, I'm gonna secede from the US government, I'd be like, okay, fine, I'm gonna build a wall around your territory, and then you can't get out.
Right. Obviously, I'm not advocating for any particular leap to this. What I'm actually advocating for is very much in line with at least what you, even though you don't seem to quite be there in embracing that universal principle of individual sovereignty. And to me, that's like the real part of the crux of my beliefs.
Okay, we're in agreement.
We're gonna have to start disengaging here a little bit.
I do agree with the principle of individual sovereignty, and I think that's why we have governments that promote and protect individual rights. That's the point.
So I'm gonna ask a quick question to both you gentlemen. It's gonna take 30 seconds. Just, I want your guys' opinion on it. What do you think is more, what you would be going for as far as justice? You had talked about theory of justice before, and I'm kind of curious, especially to Adam, but both of you can answer. What do you think is more important, retributive justice or restorative justice, especially when it came to your bike? Which would you value as a higher?
We could spend a little while debating all, or you know, defining all those terms that you use there, but if you're talking about punitive, you know, versus restorative, then definitely it's restorative, not punitive. I don't support controlling people's behavior by causing them pain or damage. I support causing whatever pain and damage is necessary to restore justice, and no more than that.
I'm happy to agree with that. I don't think a punitive justice system is a good idea. We spent a long time getting away from those. So, yeah, I mean, I personally think the English common law is the best solution we've come to so far in comparison to any of the justice systems I've seen, like, you know, Sharia or, you know, the inquisitorial French system. I think the common law system is the best one, which is incidentally what the United States is based off. So I would say stick with that.
Yeah, and I happen to agree with both gentlemen on that. All right, we got some super chats, if you just don't mind, to get out of the way. That's like about four of them. I'm going to read them off real quickly. ESO says for $2, libertarian for no more Applebee's suits. ESO says for $2, Sarga needed some fruit, so he had a dig. That's not very nice.
Say again.
He said Sarga needed some fruit so low he had a dig.
No, that's not nice. Come on.
That's not nice. Melissa Carly, $10. Wars in the 1700s are totally the same as a war would be in the 21st century. The founders were wrong. Standing armies were inevitable due to the industrial age and the nation state.
Totally agree.
And ESO says $2. At least Sargon spoke up more this time.
Didn't I speak up last time? I did.
both really good talks. You did speak up. Last time, I think people have this this expectation that you're going to come in guns blazing and you know.
I tried to be nice in person.
I was hoping for a little more condescension with that beautiful British accent. It's bringing a gun to a knife fight. You've got the British accent and the gray just perfect in the beard there. It's like this great intellectual authority, and the condescension is, it's so easy. Why not?
Yeah, very true. Yeah, but the thing is, Adam, I've seen you debating on the street against progressives, you know, collectivists, and I don't agree with your, it's not that even I don't agree with your ideal. I mean, I think that, you know, if I had the option, that does sound nice. I just think it's really never going to happen. I don't even know if it is desirable for it to happen, but I mean, ultimately, like, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I don't think it's from a place of bad intentions. And ultimately, I think you make good arguments for capitalism above things like socialism. And so I don't have any desire to try and stop you in your mission to do that, you know.
Because I want to share something then that to me is really important that I think I generally bring to the conversation around libertarianism that most people don't, which is the impact of technology today and of what we see as future technologies right around the corner. And aside from the general decline in violence, the general increase in human productivity, I think if you just factor those things and you go, well, it's kind of inevitable, how can you justify a welfare state when we are so productive as individuals that you can work for, you know, a year and support a family for 100 years at a good quality of life? And that's the nature of technology, is that the value of an hour of human labor in terms of what actual quality of life goods and services are produced from that hour of labor goes up, and that goes up exponentially with technology. The problems of communication, the drug war. I mean, the drug war is based on so many offensive lies that it's like you just can't maintain that in the age of the internet. Like, that it's ridiculous. And so I mean, I could keep going, because to me, this is what this is like really what I'm passionate about, is seeing how government is being rendered obsolete. But to use a really immediate petty example, and I don't mean the internet, which is huge, but self-driving cars. According to the U.S. government, the majority of interactions with law enforcement in the United States happen at traffic stops. Well, you can't pull people over when they're driving their own cars. Sorry, that part of the government racket just goes away. And there's so many other examples where I see the state not just becoming obsolete, but withering in its relevance to the point where it's I can't promise my political solution is going to be viable, because it might be that we render government so irrelevant by the time we have the kind of awakening that all of us have, this awareness of the nature of government, that it might be that, like, by the time, you know, in another 10 years, I'm like, yeah, I'm still a libertarian, but who cares? Cause government's already irrelevant. Or it's like, it's just, it's not.
You know, that was Karl Marx's plan for communism. You know that, right? It's funny, isn't it? You know, but
that's where I got that idea.
I've said this before. Like, I think capitalism will eventually create something that is approximating, like you were saying, this kind of a position where we're post scarcity. We're not, you know, there won't be traffic stops because, like, right. I say, there'll be self-driving cars or some mechanism that supersedes it. Like, I don't know, teleportation or something. Who knows? You know, whatever stupid invention in the future. You know, but like a lot of the problems that we've had in the past will be solved by technology. I agree that the need for these things probably will, in, like, you know, say 200 years or something, have effectively fallen away. But at the moment, we're not there. So,
yeah. Well, this is fantastic, guys. Both of you, I appreciate you you coming on, and I'm gonna let you guys now. I know, Adam, you've got a book that you want to put out there, so you can let everybody know about where they can go to find that, and then we'll send everybody to Sargon. So go ahead.
Wait, but I'm having too much fun. I can't stop. I got to respond to what he said there, because he even got a little thing at the end saying that we're not there yet.
Please, I
agree in a sense. We're not there. A lot has to happen.
Okay,
but government is well behind the awareness, and that's why this conversation is so exciting and so important. And even what Sargon is doing. Oh, Sargon, I appreciate your voice in the bigger, human conversation of the internet. I value it. I think it's really important in what I see as this beautiful dance forward of humanity. So, in my part in this, I have a couple of things that I'm focused on in my activism. One is my book Freedom that I started writing when I was in jail. It's just 100 pages, free 3-hour audiobook, free in every digital format possible. And the other one is my presidential campaign. And I cringe every time I have to introduce myself as a presidential candidate, because you really have to be some sort of psychopath to want to be president of the United States, to say, I want to have this unjust power over other human beings that shouldn't exist. So I have to point out that I'm not even going to be putting on the ring. I'm going to be throwing it directly into the fire. The platform is the peaceful, responsible dissolution of the federal government, where we immediately declare it of no authority and I resign, and initiate a process leaving us with 50 independent states. So that's localization in action. I think that is something that Americans are ready to unite around, because we don't have to be united under one government to be united in American values. So thank you all very much for this opportunity. Carl, thank you. I almost wanted to address you as Sargon this whole time.
But don't worry.
The condescension works better with the British accent, so I'll let you have it.
Did you change?
Thank you very much.
Adam, did you change from... Because last we talked to you, you were going for Arizona. Did you switch?
The Senate race was a failed little ballot access experiment that we did primarily to help the party here in Arizona, and it failed.
Good deal. So you're going back for the big time. Awesome. All right, Carl, please let everybody know where they can find more of you and follow you on any kind of social media.
You can just follow my YouTube channel, which is at, which is Sargon of Akkad, just on YouTube. And, that's my presence online mostly.
Perfect. And make sure you check out both these guys. We really appreciate you coming by and having this talk. It was fantastic.
Great.
And sorry about the tech issue, guys, at the beginning, but we got it sorted out, and I think it all wound up coming out pretty good. So we'll see you guys tomorrow at 8 p.m. and have a good evening.
Good night, all.